You are listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, or MMNHD, presented proudly in partnership with Monthly Review Online. Today, Scott Ferguson and I are joined in conversation with Alexandra Skaggs, senior writer for Barron's, who covers markets and fixed income. Skaggs' financial journalism is indispensable for a number of reasons, but we were particularly interested in speaking with her on Money on the Left about how she leverages modern monetary theory to advance some of the most perceptive and incisive analyses of the ongoing paradigm crisis in economic theory. Alexandra's recent reporting on the complex topic of repo markets is also top-notch. We touch on that as well as the inordinately powerful role played by so-called primary dealers in our present political economic arrangement. Alongside this excellent conversation, we're thrilled to announce the second meeting of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, which will be held April 24th through 26th at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. The title of the conference is Money on the Left, the Green New Deal Across the Arts and Humanities. We invite all artists, activists, and critical theorists who are committed to expanding and advancing the vision of the Green New Deal to apply to participate. For more information on the conference and guidelines for submitting a proposal, head to moneyontheleft.org. And thanks as always to our production team, Alex Williams, Richard Farrell, and Megan Soss for bringing this episode together. Alexandra Skaggs, welcome to Money on the Left.
Thanks for having me.
So could you start off by telling us a bit about your personal background and professional experience?
Sure. So I do want to say, first of all, that I'm sort of appearing in a professional capacity. I'm not like representing my publication or anything like that. I did want to mention that just first off, just so no one thinks that I'm like being super political as like a Barron's employee or something.
Understood.
Got it.
Cool. And so I joined Barron's about a year ago, and I've basically done like a kind of a quick lap of most of the business publications in New York City. Sure. I started off pretty much at the Wall Street Journal covering the stock market. Then I went to Bloomberg to cover the treasury market. Most recently, I was at the Financial Times covering credit. And then, again, about a year ago, I ended up coming over to Barron's. And here I cover pretty much all fixed income markets. That covers treasuries, emerging market debt a little bit, and credit and mortgages and other types of stuff like that.
Well, I'm curious, how does somebody like you start covering finance and making the rounds through all these New York publications?
Yeah. So it's kind of a funny story. It's something I mostly fell into, actually. I went to a school that was actually kind of conservative undergrad. It was Washington and Lee University, a little problematic now here in 2019. But I went there mostly because I wanted to play volleyball. Because I was like, oh, it's got a good team. I can play there. That's cool. And once I was there, I thought I wanted to do something that was basically going to like keep me employed.
Because that, you know, good goal.
Exactly, right? Well, that's sort of the, as it turns out, I later learned that was kind of the like millennial person's priority. Like, it wasn't just me that was like only thinking about that. I went into accounting and econ, and so I like took a bunch of classes in those departments because I sort of wanted to know how things worked. And I also thought, like, well, maybe this means I'll actually get a job outside of college, because that would be helpful, obviously. Turned out I didn't love doing it, but I did like paying attention. And I kind of realized like those were the areas where like, I guess a good way to put it is like most power is wielded. You know, there were a lot of kids going to banks. There were a lot of kids going into corporate finance. And I sort of realized like, oh, it's much more interesting to be on the outside looking in. And so I went into the journalism program, and it turns out my advisor actually she ran a business journalism program within the J school, which was kind of cool. Hmm. And I figured, well, I have the prerequisites and I can hang out in the J lab with everyone and like chat, which is mostly what I wanted to do at that point. And I also, another cool thing was I got to go out into the community a decent amount. And, you know, coming from the suburbs of, you know, Pennsylvania, wherever, going out into going out into Rockbridge County, Virginia, was really, really interesting and really eye-opening. Because Lexington, Virginia is actually, I think, one of the wealthiest per capita areas in Virginia, but Rockbridge County is one of the poorest areas per capita in Virginia. And so going out and realizing, like, oh, wow, these people are living, like, so differently from these students who are sort of, like, in this little bubble, you know, it was really sort of reorienting. And it's funny, actually, my family's from around there originally. And so, like, I was able to, like, talk to people from the community where, like, a lot of the other students weren't really. I don't know, it was an interesting experience, I guess. You know, I decided to focus on money and finance because that was sort of where most of the, I guess it's sort of how people really show what they care about. Because, like, if you don't spend money on something, it's, you know, it could just be like paying lip service, right? And I also did it because I was like, well, reasonably, like, I don't think a lot of people will want to do this. And this way I can specialize and actually, like, you know, get a job. And then 2009 happened, which was, I guess, disastrous and also kind of reoriented the entire country around, like, oh, what's actually happening in finance and markets and economics. So that was right before I graduated, which was really crazy.
Wow.
So, like, I guess those two sorts of, you know, going out into Rockbridge County and then the financial crisis hitting right as I was about to graduate, like, completely, I think, reshaped the way that I saw the world.
In your econ and finance classes, is it fair to presume that you were learning primarily orthodox economics? And then what was the transition like when you moved into the journalism school?
Yes, it was really interesting to get the economics perspective from, like, Washington and Lee, because I had a couple of really interesting micro professors, and they were really bright guys, and everything they said made sense. There was a developmental economics guy, which, you know, was not my favorite class, but then I took a class with this guy who had gotten a PhD at the Yale School of Forestry, which is, like, yeah, a very niche section of micro, and he was great on micro theory, and that ended up being a lot of fun. But the macro classes were just totally over my head, I thought, at the time. And I just, like, it seemed very, I don't know, it seemed almost like, you know, I was doing calculus in micro, and then I went to macro, and everything was, like, arithmetic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, actually, I think at that point, macro is actually arithmetic because it's, like, G plus I plus, you know. So, yeah. And then the journalism school was really, it was just very different. Like, it was things on the ground that matter to people. You know, like, I wrote about healthcare in Rockbridge County, and that was absolutely wild. I mean, the amount of the lack of institutional structure there to provide healthcare to the community was astonishing. I interviewed one guy who had, like, not gotten good dental care in decades. Like, he had gotten dentures, but then it was difficult to understand him because his dentures had gotten lost in some flood, and he didn't have anywhere else to find them, which, you know, again, like, unless you actually go into those communities and talk to people, you don't realize, like, you know, there's in your suburban, or where I grew up, I guess, in my suburban upbringing, like, no one was out there telling me, like, hey, by the way, there are people out there who, like, can't get sufficient dental care. Just wasn't a factor that, you know, I ever, you know, that I thought about, I guess, when I was, like, 16. So who actually thinks that much about that stuff when they're 16? I don't know.
So, sure. 2009 happens, and your niche becomes what everybody wants to talk about. How did your training prepare you to engage with, you know, the financial crisis?
Well, the fact that I could cover it at all, I think, you know, was helpful just because I got to sort of see it in real time. And, you know, it's interesting, though, because even at the time, like, I'm not sure I fully grasped the macro underpinnings, I guess, that caused it. Like, I knew that there was a lot of mortgage debt. I knew that there was a lot of consumer debt, or consumer debt is even this kind of a silly way to put it. But, like, I knew that people were sort of underwater, and I sort of had to piece things together from there. And it's very interesting because none of it really made sense to me until I met Rowan Gray, who I know is very active in the MMT community. And then, like, the entire thing actually made sense, which is kind of crazy.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, you know, I think another interesting thing about journalism in the U.S. and about even, you know, working after college in the U.S. is just, you know, for me, like, I had to scramble a lot to just stay employed, right? And I think that a lot of people have this experience where, like, I didn't necessarily feel like I had time to think about the financial crisis or to figure out, like, I wonder why this happened. I was like, you know, it would be great to know why this happened, but, like, I need to pay rent and, like, eat and stuff. So, like, at that moment, I was just like, okay, I'll cover the fact that the stock market rallied after this thing called QE3 that I don't really understand. And then when I moved on to Bloomberg, I was covering the treasury market. And I think that the underpinnings of the treasury market are very confusing unless you have some sort of macro, like, I guess, structure to think about it in or foundation. And around that time, actually, a friend of mine from the Wall Street Journal ended up introducing me to Rowan, who, like, sent me a bunch of literature. I mean, he was really a great advocate for MMT. He sent me a bunch of literature, sat down and, like, got coffee and talked to me about, you know, what the MMT viewpoint of macro is. And all of a sudden, like, things started coming together in a way that they hadn't before, you know, partially because, you know, the MMT community were such great advocates that it sort of made me want to think more about it.
Did you have any resistances in coming to it, either just an understanding or, I don't know, you know, biases or whatever that you brought to the table?
Oh, totally. I mean, I'm like a relatively recent comer to all of this stuff. And I think, again, like, mostly because I felt like I didn't have time or expertise to sort of think about this stuff on my own. Like, I feel like the message that you get from most places is like, oh, this stuff is really complicated. And these people, like, I don't know, Larry Summers or whoever, like, they're very smart. So they know exactly, you know, what the situation is, and you should just listen to them. And that was sort of what, you know, I was scared to sort of think about things on my own or do my own reading on macro stuff. And I do, you know, it was crazy. So I was talking to Rowan about this, and I remember, like, I sort of got into a back and forth with him, and we were talking about, I think, the division between the Treasury and the Fed. And I was like, well, the Fed independence is, like, a huge deal. Like, that's very important, you know, saying that because that was what I had been told. And that was what I had been told in undergrad. That was what I had been told after undergrad. And Rowan was like, why? And I was like, wait, hold on. And, like, I tried to answer the question and I couldn't. And the only answer I could really come up with was like, oh, well, if people figure out that the division that they think is there isn't really there, well, then, and he's like, oh, then they can actually, like, you know, take control and use money on themselves. And I was like, yeah. And that was sort of, it's so funny. I remember so clearly that moment. Because even then, I think that there's this sort of anti-populist or whatever groupthink in the media, in professional circles, that, like, oh, you know, if normal people figure out how to take power or how to sort of advocate for themselves, well, everything is lost, you know? And I was thinking about that and I was like, I can't, you know, if you don't say it out loud, then like it doesn't sound as awful as it is almost.
Yeah.
But like the more I thought about it, the more I was like, there's no actual defense for this ideological position. And then once you see the fact that the ideological position underlies so much of what's out there, like you can't really unsee it, I guess. And from there, it was sort of like, oh, wow. You know, it was a sort of radical reorientation of my view again, you know, because, you know, like, oh, all of this injustice is happening. People are being foreclosed on. And you sort of assume like, oh, this is just the way things have to be. But then talking to Rowan, I was sort of like, oh, and it's not even the way things have to be. That was like, I guess he gave the impression, and the more you pay attention, the more you realize, like, oh, there are people who understand this too. They just sort of want to keep things the way they are because, you know, they're scared of change, or they really do think that, like, oh, we can't trust people who haven't gone to Harvard, which, like, I think is absolutely absurd.
Well, it's one thing to kind of realize that that mystification has been cultivated over so long, mm-hmm. and that these norms are norms, not rules or laws that are firm. And it's another to kind of get comfortable with sort of taking that position publicly. Was it difficult for you, or was it a snap where it's like, this is the way it is, and this is the way I'm going to think about it and write about it moving forward?
Well, it was really interesting because it also helped me challenge, I think, some of the power structures in the Treasury market, actually. Because on one hand, like, you've got the Bloomberg opinion guys writing, like, explicitly ideological stuff, and, you know, they're sort of doing their thing. And it helped me first, you know, kind of identify what they were writing. But then I was doing a lot of coverage of primary dealers. And those are the groups of the groups. They're the group of banks that basically backstop Treasury auctions. And the primary dealers, it's funny, I think sort of unconsciously have a very political view of their job. In their view, they're very like, you know, we are the ones who underwrite the government's ability to borrow. Like, we are the reason the government can do stuff that it needs to do. And, like, you don't realize necessarily that's a political view until you learn MMT and you're like, oh, actually, like, the government is the one that sets all of these rules. And, like, they're, you know, you're, like, saying that you're doing all of this stuff for the government, but you're doing it on the government's playing field. So, like, who are you actually working for? And, like, it ends up sort of turning that kind of perception upside down, if that makes any sense. And that also helps me interrogate sort of the role that they played a little bit more, which ended up making me look into the sort of rules that exist for primary dealers, which again are set by the government. And it sort of allowed me to interrogate that, I think, in a way that actually made me better at my job, which was kind of cool. Because as soon as you stop sort of accepting everything that these guys tell you at face value, you're allowed to interrogate what they're doing a little bit more.
Right. We all learn in civics class about primary dealers.
I had maybe not learned in my civics class.
So do you have contentious direct interactions, like on the phone, with representatives from these primary dealer banks, where you suggest alternative viewpoints, or maybe I'm presuming too much. Do you persuade any of them?
So that's a good question. Not anymore, because I've moved on from that job. But it was funny, at the time, I actually did kind of pissed a bunch of them off, because I ended up writing about this sort of pre-auction trading thing, and it seemed like there was some room to to mess around with auctions based on this pre-auction market, and it all gets kind of niche, but that sort of led to already a contentious relationship with the primary dealers. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of them would get on the phone and just complain about Basel III regulations and be like, oh, you know, they don't know what we do for them. And like, I try to say, like, are you sure? But like, again, it's the guys on the desks, and like, they're not particularly interested in having their like viewpoint expanded. So a lot of the time, you know, you have that conversation and you're just like, if you say so. But you know, I think that my coverage hopefully, you know, helped some people reorient the way that they think about that. Because it did also help me get in touch with some of the guys who used to be at primary dealers and ended up moving on to a little bit more, sophisticated roles at like, you know, high frequency trading firms and like other kinds of, treasury market adjacent. Like not actually being a primary dealer, but sort of looking at it again, kind of from the outside, like I was. So it ended up, you know, I wish I could say I like went in there and like won hearts and minds, but I'm not sure that that's going to be the most, that was the most successful attempt.
We invited you onto Money on the Left primarily to help us shed light on what's, I think, being regarded as a paradigm crisis in mainstream econ and central banking. Could you help us figure out precisely what is happening and explain why leftists, democratic socialists, others should care about this? Maybe we can helpfully start by tracing the origins of the crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I see the origins of the crisis, or what's seen as a crisis, to the financial crisis. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, what happened during the crisis, all of the pain that was felt by people, and the news that came out in, you know, fits and starts afterwards about, you know, robo-signing and some of the misconduct that happened, you know, really sort of made people, I think it sort of broke the trust that people had in the financial system and in the representatives of the financial system. And I think it's interesting because, you know, within the financial system, it's all of these guys like sort of performing what they think is their jobs. Like, you know, they think their job is to maximize their P&L, you know, like I think that's, and there's an argument to be made that like that is actually just what bankers do. But a lot of public policy people had sort of taken, you know, the banker's job and just decided, okay, well, that just makes everything work out for the greater good, and then just let it go from there. And I think that people realized, like after the financial crisis, you know, this sort of idea that everyone like working in their best interest, you know, all together and like, you know, unrestrained trade or whatever. I think that really, the idea that that was like the best possible organization of the economy was really fundamentally broken because of the financial crisis.
So I think from my point of view, it's been a kind of a slow bleed. Clearly, at first, there was a sense that, okay, spreading tons of risk throughout lots and lots of different markets is not actually stabilizing, but totally destabilizing, and the kind of the shock and the wake up call that was the initial crisis. But since then, and our relatively weak and unequal recovery, I think has been accompanied by certain, we can say, epistemological challenges to some of the just fundamental truths of the neoclassical mainstream. And maybe you can help our listeners make sense of how these debates are happening. So, for example, maybe we can start with the kind of mythos of the independent central bank and what a central bank is supposed to do vis-a-vis fiscal policy. Like, how were these things thought about pre-financial crisis? And now, in terms of kind of meta debates, how are mainstream big players talking about these things anew?
Right, that's a good question. And I do think that the post-crisis and the government response to the crisis is again like the second part or the second domino to fall, maybe, because people really did think that the Federal Reserve was like, you know, this government entity that was out there by itself, like floating in some apolitical cloud, that was meant to, you know, sort of stabilize this almost mechanical system. Because I think people did kind of think about the financial system like it were just mechanical and again, apolitical, which we've since learned is not true. And I think that, you know, seeing what happened post-crisis and the way that the sort of the first priority was, okay, we have to help the banks, we have to fix the banks. I think that made people realize like, oh, the relationship between the Fed and the banks is not, they're not really as separate as you would think. And that means that the relationship between the government and the banks is not like an oppositional relationship, right? Like, when you have trillions of dollars of treasuries on the Fed's balance sheet, when you have the Fed buying trillions of dollars of treasuries from banks and paying banks interest on excess reserves and sort of all of this stuff, like the mechanical relationship is less, like there are fewer levels, I guess, or fewer, you know, ways to pretend to be separate between the two entities. Mm-hmm. And I think people understand that. And I think, you know, not just people in halls of power, I think actually like real everyday people have a better understanding of this than a lot of like, you know, the leading minds and, you know, punditry.
So can you maybe give us a few examples of some of the justifiably or not leading minds in punditry, how they've handled this? I mean, have there been, do you see fractures in this, you know, in this worldview, people holding on, other people moving forward?
Well, the way that it's sort of played out is actually kind of a bummer in my view, because I think that it's turned into this thing where like everyone says, okay, well, the Fed isn't political, the Fed doesn't play this game, but then like their recommendations for policy are basically based on their own politics. You can probably think pretty easily of like a major papers pundit who, you know, is very, very concerned about the deficit when, you know, now that Trump is in office, but you know, if a Democrat, say, were to get into office next, maybe the deficit wouldn't be a problem for them. Maybe the national debt wouldn't be something that they worried about. It just has sort of turned into this thing where, like, I'm not sure that they necessarily realize it, but you know, I guess maybe also that's where the cracks have shown up, right? Like, if you have these people saying sometimes, like, okay, well, you know, the national debt, we shouldn't say is 20 trillion or whatever, because actually that isn't the right way to measure it. Like, you start seeing the kind of contradictions in their own messages and like that's definitely getting out there to normal people, I think.
So you're saying it's less of a clear paradigm shift and more of the cracks in the edifice themselves becoming more and more apparent to more and more people.
Yes, definitely. And I think that real people are actually starting to get more interested in this stuff too, mostly because like Americans love like a tale of elite deception or self-deception. Mm-hmm. And so, and like, this is a pretty clear example, I think, of, you know, the establishment itself kind of deceiving itself. And like the jig is almost up, but like a few people are still kind of holding on here and there. And so, you know, it's funny because this is one of the things where I'm like, I actually think like, if you just sort of look at it and like talk to people about like, okay, well, this is how money is made. This is sort of why the message that they tell you about like, oh, the treasury market's gonna, you know, blow up and China's gonna foreclose on us. Like none of that actually makes sense. People actually start getting it, you know? I think some of it depends on like prior, you know, political ideas and stuff like that. But I think I think the distinction, I guess, between like the group of pundits, you know, here in New York or down in DC and like regular people is growing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think that there's a kind of lag or translation failure between punditry and everyday people's interests and our political rhetoric. I think on the one hand, you know, we see much, we see politicians, and certainly in this presidential race, talking about much, you know, a lot more large government programs that are going to cost a lot of money. But for some reason, none of that rhetoric or framing seems to be tapping into the fact that a lot of the mainstream econ and finance discourse has been calling for more fiscal policy, especially in the case of another major crisis. Not like we're not already in one, but yeah. You know, we pretend like we're not.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts about how the econ and finance discourse kind of interacts with that popular political rhetorical situation.
Yeah, it's interesting because I also, you know, the sort of, I feel like I actually get to chat with like a pretty wide range of folks, and like, depending on like where you're at, it's very funny to see the like class breakdown, because I think that like people in like the professional class or like people who went to like fancy law schools, you know, I think they're the few people who are left sitting there like, oh, well, you know, God knows how we're going to pay for all of this, you know? And I think that's just because, like, you get cultural brownie points for, like, agreeing with Larry Summers. I'm not sure. But among, like, other people who don't have quite the, I guess, investment in the establishment or, like, the sort of power structure that's in place now, like, they don't trust the messages that they're getting told at all. So, like, If you start talking about it and be like, yeah, well, you know, so-and-so says we can't afford it, but then, like, look at the cost of the military programs that we have. Look at the cost of the military technologies we have. Like, look at what's happened with QE and post the financial crisis. Like, they are absolutely willing and ready to hear it. And, like, it just rings a sort of, it resonates a lot more, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that the, you know, then when you start getting into the separation between the Fed and the Treasury and, like the role of taxation, that's been a little tougher, I think. Actually, it's pretty funny, but it is a good message. I was talking to someone the other week about taxing billionaires. And it was very funny because it was someone who was like, you know, sort of middle class, like did pretty well. But they were talking about like, oh, well, if they take Jeff Bezos's money, like, why wouldn't they take mine too? And I know, right? And I was like, okay, it was kind of sad because I was like, well, I'm not sure they really care about your money. And then, but like, that's actually the perfect opening for MMT, because then you can say like, oh, well, the thing is that taxes aren't actually the government getting money for its programs. Like, the reason you tax people like Jeff Bezos is just so they have less power, you know, so they direct the political process less. And then I kid you not, the person was like, responded with a like, oh, well, like, what, are they just going to set the money on fire then? And I was like, that is literally MMT. That is taxation destroys money and appropriations create it.
Yes. And there's a long history, right, of tax day actually being a money burning day.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, like, those sorts of intuitive conclusions that come from that, like, I think that that's, I guess, part of the reason that MMT resonated so much with me. It's because, like, oh, this actually makes perfect sense. But then once you accept that, like, the sort of implications are sort of a radical paradigm shifting thing.
Well, no, there's a lot to be to sort of think about here. And I guess one of the things that's coming to mind as we're talking about, you know, chatting with people about MMT and, you know, popular reactions to seeing, you know, the bailouts of the banks as opposed to bailing out homeowners. You attended the most recent MMT conference, and I think one of the interesting things about the MMT conference is that it is pretty public facing, and there were a lot of activists there from different states, backgrounds, but very interested and motivated to sort of bring MMT to their communities and to their local politicians and to sort of change the discourse that way from the bottom up. I wonder if you might comment on your experience at the MMT conference and perception of the kind of mass movement that appears to be nascent there, or at least forming, or the energy anyway in the MMT community.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was so inspiring to see, you know, it was inspiring to see and meet the activists and sort of look at the great work that they've been doing. It was also interesting and kind of encouraging to see the non-activists that were there, because I do think that most of the people in attendance were activists and like doing really, really important work and people who have been there since the very beginning. But, you know, since we're talking about the discourse, you know, talking about the sort of spread of MMT, like I met a few people at the conference too who weren't activists and were just like professional guys who drove over for a couple of days because they were curious. And like that is fascinating to me, because again, that's that same group that like, you know, gets brownie points for listening to Larry Summers, like I said. So like, if you're reaching them, then like, that's really wild. And, you know, I think that seeing the way that the movement has grown has been so cool and so encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just to shift to another, I think, major topic, is a place where the cracks in the system are becoming quite visible is in basically all kinds of assumptions about inflation and how inflation works and what its relationship to unemployment supposedly is. What's your sense of the way that has been framed in the past and the way that's being challenged? And again, I'm interested in a correct analysis, but I think I'm specifically in this case interested in what the big players, you know, people like Olivier Blanchard, for example, are saying about these things.
Oh yeah, I mean, it used to be like a boogeyman, inflation. Like, even I'd say even like the big voices, you know, were Bill Gross, after the financial crisis, was convinced that QE was going to cause hyperinflation, you know, and he talked about it a lot, and he talked about it really publicly, and he got run over like 100%. And, you know, I think, I'm blanking on the guy's name from GMO, but, you know, the people who have been right have been the people who pay attention to MMT, to the people who are sort of, you know, basically carrying out their like jobs within finance, but with an MMT perspective, which is very interesting, I think. Because those are not the traditional like people that you'd expect to see at a conference of like, you know, progressive economists. But they are the people who, you know, they're putting their money where their mouths are, I guess, and it's been working out for them. So that's another sort of interesting thing. And you have seen like Olivier Blanchard, for example, came out and started talking about how like, well, okay, as long as growth is higher than interest rates, then you're okay. I mean, you, Scott, you're probably better placed to talk about the specifics of the economics of it offhand, but the way that they're sort of dialing back their inflation warnings has been, it seemed a little like a CYA effort. But, you know, on the other hand, I guess it's encouraging that people are changing their views after, God knows, 10 years without any inflation at all. You know, the idea that there is some sort of level of employment above which or unemployment below which inflation gets out of control, I think that's pretty much been debunked now, right? Like,
yeah, and within the mainstream.
Yeah, right?
They're not becoming MMTers, but
yeah,
but they see they don't really have two legs to stand on anymore.
Exactly. And you know, even some of my really bright colleagues have come out very strongly against the idea that there is an unemployment level that like, oh, that's the ideal amount of unemployment. Because that, you know, the whole idea is sort of reactionary and problematic. Especially especially in a country where healthcare is tied to employment. It's like, ugh.
Yep. And that's racist and sexist.
Yeah.
And of course, so it's people of color and women who suffer the most.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I think that, actually, I think that the Fed has realized this. I think that the Fed has realized that at least people are not willing to accept the idea anymore that there should be some sort of like reserve army of unemployed people. Because that idea, I think, resonates a lot with people. Because they've been hearing from, you know, mainstream media publications like, oh, well, unemployment's this low, maybe inflation's going to start now. And I think at this point, like, A, unemployment has fallen a lot and inflation hasn't picked up. And second, like, I think people are more willing to challenge the Fed's point of view post the financial crisis.
Yeah, and sometimes directly and in their face, like, Fed up movement.
Exactly. And I do, you know, the Fed is not traditionally the most responsive of institutions to,
what?
I know, right? to the public at all, really. But I do think that they've been paying attention, and I think that they're a little, I mean, this is pure speculation, but like, it seems to me like they're a little freaked out.
Yeah, and they're doing damage control. They're holding conferences, and at least they're acknowledging that they have to be somewhat answerable to the public, even if it's totally not satisfactory. What they're doing, it's very much, again, maybe another piece in this paradigm crisis puzzle that we're trying to unpack.
Exactly. And I think you can link a lot of that to the great work that FedUp's been doing, right? Like, you know, they're there. And I think that, like, as people start to pay attention more and as people, you know, listen to that message, you know, normal people, again, are going to be like, oh, why is it that they want unemployment to be 3% or 4%? You know, so I think they've been doing really great work and really effective, it would seem.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stopped trying.
What's the deal with repo markets?
Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Repo, oh, God. Yeah, repo's been taking over my life, actually. But that's another thing, right? Like, it's so funny that you see people online freaking out that the Fed is intervening in repo markets, which, like, that's how it implemented policy before the financial crisis. Like, the only reason any person would worry about this is if they had the assumption that the Fed should not be in money markets, which, again, mm-hmm. seems to me like an extremely neoliberal assumption. Because,
yeah, go ahead. Can you explain just repo 101, just basics? What is it? How does it function? What's been the nature of the crisis?
Yeah. So it's probably easiest to start talking about it from, like, the way things worked before the financial crisis, and then talk about what happened during and then after. And I also think that this is one thing that sort of, you know, blows up the assumption that the Fed is not, like, is not actively involved in markets every single day, you know? So before the financial crisis, banks had a certain amount of, like, cash reserves in their accounts at the Fed. And, like, from day to day, you know, one bank would be a little bit short reserves, cash, you know, whichever, and then another bank would have a little extra. And so they'd have these sort of short-term loans where they would, and this actually isn't repo, this is in the Fed funds market. So they'd, like, make just short-term loans of cash to one another, you know, bank to bank, you know, no matter which one, usually overnight, or I think sometimes intraday, but again, I'm not totally the expert on this. Mm-hmm. And then after the financial crisis, or I guess during the financial crisis, the Fed bought bonds from the banks, which created a ton of extra cash reserves. So then, like, banks had more than they needed, and then some. Then the Fed started shrinking its balance sheet. Banks sort of stopped making short-term cash loans to each other in the way that they were doing before. And instead of that, they've been making short-term cash loans, but basically taking a treasury in return. So it's been like one bank will need cash because cash is a little bit better than treasuries for various things. And so a bank will pledge a treasury with another bank to get that cash.
And am I mistaken in presuming that usually this is happening so that the banks can meet their reserve requirements?
More or less. So one of the interesting things is that, and this is for reserve requirements and other purposes like regulatory stuff. But one of the interesting things is that after the financial crisis, global banking regulators said, okay, on top of all of these reserve cash requirements that you have, we're going to say you need a certain amount of high quality liquid assets. And high quality liquid assets can be cash or treasuries. So, and the thing that sort of has confused regulators is, you know, back in September, the rates at which banks were borrowing cash from each other short term spiked really high. And it was
that's the crisis.
Yeah, this is the new repo crunch or crisis or, you know, whatever you'll call it.
Madness.
Yes, definitely repo madness. And so, the rates ended up spiking really high. And so the Fed said, okay, like, we want things to get back to normal. So we're going to intervene in the market and we'll start lending out cash, you know, in exchange for these treasuries, short term at like a preset rate that's closer to the rate that we actually have. Like, that's our policy rate. But, and so, you know, people seem to think that like this is, you know, financial crisis 2.0 and every, you know, the sky is falling. But it's sort of interesting because this is actually the way that the Fed implemented policy before the crisis. So like before the crisis, when banks are lending reserves to each other short term, like every once in a while, they're like, wouldn't be enough. So whenever that was the case, the Fed would come in and lend out reserves short term. Like, this was like a pretty standard thing. Now, that was usually happening in pretty small volume. And what people have been paying attention to this last time around is that the Fed's been doing it in large volume. So banks, for whatever reason, need a large amount of extra cash, and they're willing to put up treasuries for it. And this is sort of interesting because I do think it gets into the distinction between, like, what's really the difference between cash and a treasury. You know, you can do a lot of things with treasuries. You can sell them really easily. You cannot pay taxes with them, I don't think. Like, that's one of the distinguishing factors. But, like, both of them are obligations of the U.S. government, more or less. And so I find it really interesting that, like, this is sort of the way that the Fed is implementing policy, because it's basically saying, like, okay, well, like, you know, the Treasury's obligations are like pretty good, but like definitely not as good as our obligations. And in order to enforce that, we're going to go into the market and lend out cash a lot in exchange for Treasury obligations. So that's just sort of a tangent, but.
No, I think it's actually central. And just to drive home the point that without being totally deterministic, it seems to me that it's pretty fair to say that this repo madness is an effect of policy or multiple regimes, including Basel III and other regulations. And then I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but the choice to begin a taper process whereby the government is essentially depriving this already fragile system of liquidity such that it creates a crisis.
Yeah, for sure. So I should have probably talked about that in a little bit more detail. Like, the tapering of the Fed's balance sheet was basically like, okay, well, we're going to stop buying so many bonds at Treasury auctions, because the Fed had been buying actually a decent amount. Which means that those bonds are going to be at the banks, basically, instead of on the Fed's balance sheet. So, but the Fed, this is all part of the Fed's desire for things to get back to, like, quote-unquote normal, whatever that means, which means that, like, for them, that means, okay, well, we still want, like, a scarce amount of cash at the banks. And, again, it's not clear to me, like, why it is that they wanted that. Like, I don't think they ever really made the argument for it in any really compelling way. I think that they just wanted it to be back to normal, and they want it to seem like they're not really like intervening, even though they intervene regularly just to keep their policy in place.
Right. And they play this ideological game of peekaboo.
Yeah.
Where they're sort of pretending that they're not always in charge, and conditioning what's happening, and then
it seems like they intervene to remind you that they're independent.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, oh, God. Yeah, they're like, we're intervening, but then we're going to intervene less just to, you know, because we want to keep the appearance of independence. But again, as we've seen, that didn't work because it was after a full 2 years of that, that, you know, the market for those cash loans secured by treasuries ended up kind of blowing up. So like the rate for borrowing cash went above 5%, I think. Even though the Fed's rate, like policy rate, was around like 2 at the time. And actually, some of those transactions went almost up to 10%, but that's kind of a different story.
I'm just wondering, as we're talking about all this, as I'm like sort of tracking the fancy dancing in my head.
Yeah.
It just all seems so terribly inefficient, and I wonder what might be accomplished if, I mean, that's the MMT game, a large part of it, right, is like, why are we doing this? What could we be doing otherwise? And how much more effective and efficient would that be? And it just seems like all of this is tied up with that independence rhetoric. It's like this, we need to preserve and maintain this notion that the Fed and the Treasury are just completely independent from each other. But it's what cost?
Well, it's funny because you could argue, and I'm not saying that I'm arguing this necessarily, but you could argue that the primary dealers are basically a front for the lack of independence between the Fed and the Treasury. Hmm. You know, like they sit in the middle, the Treasury sells bonds, the primary dealers sort of underwrite them, and then the Fed lends cash against Treasury bonds from the primary dealers. So, like, it's literally like a shell game, or not like a, you know, I'm trying to think. I don't want to get in trouble. So, like, shell game is, like, a little problematic, maybe. But it's, like, you know, going from one hand to another, but just, you know.
Money laundering?
Fencing?
I'm going to leave that to you guys. But
yeah. No, we said it. Yeah. So, just remember to listeners, you got to elect progressive primary dealers next election.
No, well, it's like they're charging these are literally the big banks. They're the big U.S. banks. And what they're doing is they're charging rent, basically, in between the Treasury's auctions of Treasury securities and the Fed's short-term cash loans secured by Treasuries. You know, like that sort of like two-sided market, we can call it. Like the primary dealers are in the middle of that, and they exist to make it seem like it's private market, and they earn money from it. Like they're basically charging rent to be in the middle of that big market.
Yeah, absolutely, and this is why the MMT proposal to push the overnight rate down to zero.
Yeah.
Is so important because it's about bringing a democratic accountability and a more democratic ordering to the way our financial system is organized in the first place, rather than through this shell game of private markets.
Exactly.
One question I have for you to kind of come back to your own personal experience is about gender. And it seems to me that econ and finance has historically been very much a man's world, a white man's world. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your experience has been, and if you'd like to speak to any of those questions.
Oh, that's a good one. It's funny because, you know, it's now impossible for me to see this like outside of like a sort of economic framework, right? Like the sort of, I don't know, like a economic left kind of view, because when I first got into the business, it was kind of tough because like people didn't take me very seriously. I was new, I was young. I didn't have a lot of like negotiating power. And that was really super frustrating, right? But then like, you know, you sort of advance a little bit and people start treating you a little bit better. But like, even then, you know, people have their shticks, right? Like, you know, I know a lot of women that I know in financial journalism have to sort of like fit themselves into sort of like a predetermined box, right? Like if you remind somebody of, you know, like their daughter, then, you know, it ends up being that kind of relationship with a source. Like
oh, the source, not your editor.
Oh, yeah. So internally, it's a little, internally, it's weird. But I think that's a lot like any other place of work.
Sure.
But like with the sort of relationship with the people in the financial industry, like, again, it's like a commercial relationship, right? So it sort of flattens you into a one-dimensional person and you sort of have to like play a role. And it's, you know, it's, I wouldn't say, I mean, I think it's like moderately more dehumanizing for women and other people and, you know, minorities and people who don't necessarily fit within one of those, you know, boxes that powerful people usually fit into. Mm. But, you know, lately I've been thinking also that just, you know, these sorts of like extremely commercial relationships are all sort of dehumanizing and kind of depressing. So, I mean, and I'm not like, I do, you know, I have a lot of good, like, long-term source relationships, but, like, those are different, right? Because you actually get to know them as people, and they get to know you as a person. But, you know, the sort of highly intermediated, highly commercial type of relationship is very one-dimensional and challenging.
What about advancement in the field or opportunities for,
yeah,
for covering certain kinds of stories?
Yeah, historically it's been pretty tough, I would say. I mean, some outlets have made a lot of progress and have worked, you know, pretty hard to make progress. But even so, like, it's still pretty rare that you find, like, powerful women in financial journalism or even in finance. You know, and without that sort of, like, path forward, it can be kind of difficult to, you know, see yourself at a publication or an institution for like the long term, I think, because there's sort of no path and, you know, benefits aren't always necessarily great. You know, I feel like I shouldn't talk like specifically about different places.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Don't, you know,
you want to work,
but it is nice to eat and have rent. Page.
This seems like a beautiful time to transition to another question. Sure. You're talking about dehumanization and the commercial relationship, and it's nice to have money for rent and benefits.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about your own politics and maybe a bit about beyond journalism, if and how MMT has shaped your political perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have taken a pretty hard shift left, you know, just to say over the past 5 years, I guess, and that the source of that is entirely MMT.
Wow.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I hadn't thought as much as probably I should have about a lot of these sort of political topics because, you know, if you go around day to day and you think like, okay, well, like, yeah, there are political problems in the world and yes, activism is important, but like, you know, that I felt like I couldn't like afford it. Right. you know, just cause you know, rent and food and all that stuff. But it's been interesting sort of since learning about MMT, you know, again, it's sort of a thing that you see and you can't unsee. And then when you see sort of how skewed that policy like makes power relations between powerful establishments like the primary dealers or like the Fed and sort of everyone else, it just feels very wrong, you know, and it's very difficult to say and to tell yourself like, oh, well, you know, I just don't trust people, you know, like I think that a lot of the fundamental view behind thinking that the Treasury and the Fed should be separate is basically saying, like, I believe that the public will run away with themselves and ruin everything if you actually trust them with their own money. And, like, I can't morally believe that, right? Like, when everything's seen as it's sort of a mechanical process, which, like, I think a lot of people still think of economics as a mechanical process, you know, you can believe certain things, but once the ideology is unmasked, you have to look at it and decide, basically. And I couldn't in good conscience decide to think, like, oh, well, you know, people suck. Like, you know, that's just not, was not for me. And maybe for better or worse, I also struggle to keep my mouth shut about it. So, but, you know, I also think that there shouldn't be, you know, I think there is a huge, huge lack of people who are willing to talk about this stuff, who understand it well enough and who have the sort of good conscience to actually say out loud, like, no, this is actually what it means to believe that there's, like, a huge separation between the Treasury and the Fed. You know, because a lot of people who are, you know, nice people who, like, you know, are lovely humans don't feel confident enough to challenge it. Right. And, yeah, and then that's sort of how it perpetuates itself, right? It's like this it's this insidious thing. And so, you know, because, you know, thank goodness, thank God, like, Rowan actually sat me down and was like, no, this is actually what it means. You know, I had to see it, and now I feel like I have to tell other people about it.
Yeah, that's a familiar feeling.
Yeah.
And I think what has become increasingly clear to me, and was, you know, one of the reasons why we invited you on to help us think about this kind of epistemological crisis, is that, you know, it's not just that MMT has a better description and opens up politics to radical alternatives. It's that the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah.
and knows it, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not just that, it's not MMT in a vacuum. It's no, the mainstream, for the first time since the 70s, is undergoing an epistemological breakdown. And MMT has an alternative. It has an answer. And many of the, I think, the positions that the mainstream is now flirting with are pointing in the direction of MMT, even while they, you know, keep MMT at a distance and pretend that, no, that's still, that thing over there is crazy and I'm not that.
Right. And MMT not only has an answer, but it's a humane answer, right? Like, it's an answer where, you know, you don't just take half of the population and say, oh, sorry, you know, you lost the lottery that you get whenever mm-hmm. you're born to whoever your family is. You know, it's something that makes you think, like, oh, we can actually build a better society. We can build a better United States with this. And you can do it. It's not a zero-sum game, basically.
And it removes that, or it sort of stages a confrontation when you remove the neoclassical, neoliberal framework of the economy, and it just, you sort of lay bare the moral assumptions.
Yeah.
And you force a confrontation. But this is what 5% unemployment as a metric for inflation means for people. Here's what it means for you to you know, define things that way. That's I think one of the most exciting things about MMT is, yeah, the emperor has no clothes, and those articles of clothing that they're wearing are you know, soaked in blood.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I was so mad. Like, you know, after realizing sort of like what the ideological assumptions were behind of all of this, and then seeing people write about this stuff, and like, it's people that, you know, they understand it. Like, it just made me so mad because I felt like I had been duped. You know, mm-hmm. like, you have so many people out there thinking like, oh, I'm a decent person. I just, you know, this is the way decent people think about things. And you know, underneath it is this sort of horrible zero sum, you know, all against all type of thing. And like, it doesn't actually have to be that way. I was so mad about it for like, I mean, maybe I still am, who knows?
Yeah, hopefully you still are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I definitely get mad on social media sometimes.
I've seen it.
Yeah, so, you know, it's just the sort of disingenuous, like, you know, distrust of normal people really gets to me. And I do think it gets to most Americans too, right? And it gets to most people, hopefully. You know, having a system that is set up to sort of like screw over the normal regular person is just, and you know, even more so vulnerable populations. You know, I think that's something that everyone should get mad about. And I think more and more they are, because it keeps getting worse.
And so people should definitely follow you on social media for that. They should also read your Baron's work. Is there anything else that you're working on or getting ready to work on that you'd like people to know about?
Yeah, so I am hopefully getting started with a Substack newsletter relatively soon. You know, mostly because a lot of these things, like, you know, the sort of smaller aspects of, like, you know, where does the government and the private sector actually separate? Like, I've been covering Pacific Gas and Electric a lot, and that is one of those classic, like, you know, the PG&E maintains the grid, but its revenue is determined by the government, and, like, how did we actually decide that this is the way that things are? Like, I'm hoping to dig more into the history of that, and, you know, sort of more of a working model of, like, you know, how you regulate or how you think about, I guess, these sorts of utilities, like whether it's a financial utility or a electric utility or anything like that. So hopefully I'll have more clear thoughts about it by the time I publish something. Fingers
crossed. Great. And so listeners should just follow you on Twitter and you'll make announcements and tell us where to go to find these things.
Yeah, for sure. I'll post links. And hopefully keep you guys updated that way.
And maybe just one last question.
Sure.
Do you think, so we've talked with a bunch of people who are, I think, engaging with and extending MMT in interesting ways. Are there any like sort of new directions or sort of uncovered areas that you'd like to see MMT applied to or thought, you know, thought through the lens of MMT?
You know, I'm really interested, and I know there's some people doing some work on this, I'm really interested in the relationship between municipal governments and the federal government.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, the state of Pennsylvania, for example, doesn't have a printing press. However, it kind of has this like semi-implicit backing from the federal government, but then not really because there's no actual bankruptcy statute for it. So like, there are a lot of really interesting questions there, I think.
Yeah, agreed. I think municipal and state level finance is an area that we all have to dig into a lot more and get into the written laws, to the unwritten laws, to the just kind of de facto assumptions that organize those politics.
For sure. And Puerto Rico is a really interesting case of that too, but that's probably like three other episodes, and you guys may have already done them, which is also possible. Oh, someday I'll keep an eye out.
We hope to. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with us on Money on the Left.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.